the Rebel Radio Podcast. It is the Ides of March are upon us, March 1st.
That's right.
2024 is just rolling along, full steam ahead. You know,
and that's in the third month of the year already, dude.
I know, man. It seems like I was just opening Christmas gifts the other day. And now it's the winter's going away, at least in our state. And well, not that it ever really got here. And spring is rolling in, and we're on the verge of a eclipse in about a month, which, you know, and that seems kind of crazy. What is it, like a lunar solar eclipse, something like that? Yeah,
it's a total eclipse of the heart.
That's it. Oh Lord.
Yeah.
You fucked hard. But damn it, Matt, you made me lose my train of thought.
Yeah.
You know, we have we live in an age with film where we get reboots and remakes and reimaginings, you know, and some are done very well, like the Planet of the Apes films. Some are done mediocrity, like what comes to mind, RoboCop.
RoboCop.
Some are just flat out unnecessary. There's a lot of those remakes. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. And then
you try and forget about that, you know? You try and push those down.
Yeah. There's a lot of legacy sequels. Again, some are good, like Blade Runner 2049, and some are not so good with these legacy sequels. And those are continuing. We're getting a Karate Kid legacy sequel later this year, early next year or something. Those things aren't going away. But then there's movies that, you know, you hold personal, that you don't want to ever see remade. And we got our first look this week at Bill Skarsgård's version of The Crow, being directed by Rupert Sanders. And we haven't gotten a trailer yet, so we don't want to judge this too unfairly. We just got some images. And the internet went ablaze over it. No, of course, as expected, because it doesn't look like Eric Draven. Looks like Bill Skarsgård as a Dollar Tree version of the Joker.
Yes, the great value version from Walmart.
And nothing against Bill Skarsgård. He's actually a really good young actor. I really like him in everything I've seen him in. But Rupert Sanders, and they can say all the right stuff about they're holding true to the legacy of what The Crow is, and Brandon Lee and all that. And let me be clear, I understand art and that everything's an interpretation, and you can have different versions of it, but the biggest thing about The Crow is it's already a beautiful piece of art by James Barr, the creator, the artist, the writer. And if you're going in the Brandon Lee film, you know, took some liberties as far as how the comic book is to create that best version of the time in 1994. And of course, we all know about the tragedy of Brandon Lee and how the film almost didn't get released. And then the studio and people came together to release the film and finish it. So they finished it to the best of their ability. We know that there were things that were cut from the film that were a little truer to the comic book, but they had to due to special effects and the loss of Brandon. But the film still came out pretty damn good. I mean, it's one of my favorites of all time, and an amazing performance from Brandon, and pretty true to James O'Barr's vision and his art, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're going to remake The Crow, I don't see why you need to reimagine it, which it appears they're doing in this version with Rupert Sanders and what he said about it. Why not take the concept art that already exists as artwork and truly make The Crow on the big screen, page from page from the comic? I know people say, oh, if I wanted to read the comic on screen, I'd read the comic on screen. Okay, that's fair, but the comic's perfect. Envision that on the screen.
Why the wheel has already been invented.
Why reimagine a story that's already good?
Why why are you looking at the wheel and saying, you know what would be great if it had corners?
Right.
That's what I feel like this is. So like, you know what if, I know the wheel is great, but what if it was a triangle? It's like, that doesn't work.
People's other arguments are like, well, you already made up your mind you weren't going to see it anyway. Not necessarily. I think if they release an image of Bill Skarsgård, like the fan art that was out there where he has long hair, the black suit on, he's painted up like Kara Draven, I honestly probably would have spent, okay, give it a shot.
Yeah.
You know? But when I see something that doesn't look like, yeah. But when I see something that doesn't look like my vision of what I believe the Crow should be, then it just turns me off immediately. And yes, I've kind of made up my mind. I won't say I won't ever see it. But I'm not going to go to the theater and see it. You know, I'll just wait.
No.
Yeah. And when the trailer comes out, I'll give the trailer a chance, but I'm not holding out hope. I had already read things about this film in the test screening that imply that the bad guy has powers too, that he doesn't even become the Crow until the last 20 minutes of the film, which is bizarre to me. Cause if you've ever read the Crow, he's the Crow throughout the entire film book. I read that it's, instead of a random act of violence, which is what is so important to the idea of the Crow, and to what James O'Barr dealt with, that it's another situation where Shelley gets herself in trouble and causes them to get killed. Which that makes no sense, you know? So you're changing things that I just feel don't need to be changed from what I've read about this version of Crow. And I love the Alex Proyas, the director of the 1994 film. His little troll was like, okay, next reboot. Thanks. Alex understands the fans, and he understands what his movie meant. He understands what Brandon meant to people, and he understands what the book and the Crow means to people. So I think he's on the hardcore fan side. And to flip flop all that, I hope it turns out well for Bill Skarsgård and those involved in the film. And maybe we'll be proven wrong. I would love to be proven wrong, but my hopes aren't real high on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's weird seeing him with a damn mullet, It's like,
it was hard to tell from
the I feel like I would be rooting for the bad guys if they walked up and like cut it off. Like, yeah, cut the mullet off. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just looks weird, to me. Just the way they styled him. Eric Draven doesn't have a mullet. Like you said, what's really important is that, he has this vengeance within him to settle what the people did to him and Shelley. It's like without that as the driving factor and that boom at the beginning of the movie, I don't think it's the Crow.
Test screening leaks also said that he bounces back and forth between the living and the dead in this film, which I was like, wait, what? The whole point is the Crow brings him back to get vengeance. He doesn't bounce back and forth.
Yeah.
Thought that was interesting.
He's a ghost whisperer.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
For a long time, James O'Barr himself was involved with the remake going back to years ago. When it was being in the 2000s, when I spoke to James, it was Luke Evans was involved. And at that time they were really talking about doing a hyper-realistic version right off the comic pages. Luke Evans said, if he's going to make this movie, he wants to make the comic live action. Even when Jason Momoa was involved, it seemed to be like they were going to take it right from the pages. Yeah. So if these rumors about the test screenings are true and something happened between, I wonder how much O'Barr is still involved. Maybe he got to the point where he was just done with it and O'Barr made his money, sold the rights, whatever. He's probably a producer by name. So I wonder how much he's still hands-on with this compared because the previous projects, he was there when the Brandon Lee film was being made, it's an amazing legacy what O'Barr gave us. He drew this down on a piece of paper to deal with his feelings for losing his fiance. He never intended for it to be as successful was because he wasn't looking for success. He's very, if you ever meet James O'Barr and listen to him talk, he's beyond thankful for the fans and what they've done for his success. And he gives it all back to them. Super nice guy. Because he realizes that this was something he did to cope with something he lost, and he gave it to the world and it became a phenomenon and it blows his mind. He'll even tell you, he goes, man, I can't fucking believe that this turned my life into this. And he's a real modest guy, So, you know, hopefully they stay true to his vision in this new film the best they can. And we'll see, man. You know, but I don't know. I just, it's odd that it has a summer release date too. It feels like, unless it's absolutely awesome and mind blowing, it's going to kind of get lost in the summer films. It's coming out like June 7th, which is, you know, right after, I don't know what the big Memorial Day weekend movie is. I kind of remember off the top of my head. Now I can't remember, but you know, it just seems kind of like it might get lost in the shuffle of things.
Yeah. And no trailer. That's odd at this point. I mean, we already have one for Deadpool, and Deadpool's, you know, coming out, you know, not long after. And
I think by the time we record next week, the trailer will be out. I have a feeling it's coming.
Has to. They've got still pictures and stuff. It's got to be coming.
Yeah, but the crazy thing about this, though, is it got me thinking. I'll have a little fun with this. And I made a really quick throw together top five. I didn't tell you to make one because I wanted to just have some fun with it. Movies that should never be remade. And obviously The Crow's on that list without saying. But I just threw these down in no particular order. Raiders of the Lost Ark. You
easily
never remake it. You know, you can never capture that ever again, the excitement of Indiana Jones and the search for the Holy Grail and all that. It just can never be done. The second movie is another Steven Spielberg movie, Jaws. I mean, just that moment when you're 1976 and you're seeing that for the first time, there is no way that film could ever be remade and capture that excitement ever again for any audience. Whether you were born when it came out or you were younger, like you, Maddie, saw it when you were born years later, Jaws can never be recaptured and have that same moment on screen again. Star Wars, you know, that you just can't. You can't ever remake Star Wars in that same way. Now here's a couple of fun ones I put on the list. You know, obviously Star Wars, Big Trouble, Little China. I know it's not a perfect movie, and The Rock has been talking about remaking this for years, and it seems like it's kind of falling apart. Not only is Dwayne Johnson getting too old probably to make it, it's also just, I think Dwayne, of all people, has got to realize, like, you know, we just can't do this, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, you can't capture that feeling that John Carpenter got in 1986 to make a fun cult classic like that. And lastly, this has always been a running joke between my cousin and some other friends, and maybe even you, Matt, can't remember, the fucking Con Air, man. Con Air is the quintessential 90s action film. And it's pretty god dang perfect and a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You couldn't make that in audiences take it seriously or not seriously at all if you made it today, because audiences are starting to get a little smarter, you know, I guess it's fair to say.
Yeah, no, and then man, what's funny is I had watched The Rock, so I had watched another Bay film.
Well, Bay didn't do the Con Air. He just
didn't.
No, it was Simon West. Uh-huh. It was one. It was those. It was that with that era of 90s directors that tried to copy Bay.
Okay, that's why. Yeah, very Bay esque.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm gonna say Enter the Dragon. Enter the Dragon. You can't remake Enter the Dragon.
Well, I think Enter Dragon, you couldn't remake it with the talent of Brandon of Bruce Lee, obviously. But you could do a Kung Fu tournament movie. I mean, Mortal Kombat is kind of that, you know. In a way.
But yeah. And yeah, if you
you couldn't remake it directly.
No. It would have to be Enter the Dragon-esque. You know,
right. It would be something that would be inspired by, like all these movies are inspired by Seven Samurai, those kind of films. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
would say Terminator/Terminator 2. You can't redo it. Yeah. It's perfect. Those are perfect films, in my opinion. It captured
the only reason I would argue that is because of the sequels that have caused a necessary reboot at this point, if they're going to do any more. Does that make sense?
That's
fair. I'm not, and I wouldn't say remake the films, obviously, but I think you could reboot Terminator. Is that fair to say? You couldn't remake them, but you could reboot it because the sequels have caused a need to reboot it if they're going to make more.
Yeah, they'd have to do something like Skynet has taken control of the timeline.
Right.
Everything's all fucked up. John Connor doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. You know, and they'd just clean the slate.
Right. Kind of like you wouldn't remake Alien or Aliens, but you could reboot Alien at this point, which apparently is what Romulus might be, you know. So, you know, things like that. Yeah. You know, those movies that have those convoluted sequels that have caused a necessary reboot, I think is fair to say, you know.
Yeah. I would say Rocky. You can't remake Rocky.
No. And there's no need to. I mean, you know, I think when Stallone had that idea of doing a prequel about Rocky, he realized it was a bad idea and that's why he dropped it.
Yeah.
You know. It made absolutely no sense. Why would you make a prequel? You were a bouncer on the streets, you got a shot at the title. What's there a prequel to tell about? That you had no money, you were poor?
Yeah. And then I do agree with Star Wars, but that's too easy. So I would probably say.
When I was making the list, I was thinking like some of the classic Eastwood Westerns, but honestly, as good, really the only one I wouldn't touch is Good and Bad and the Ugly. Some of those other ones, you could probably remake them a little more exciting, more action packed, and wouldn't take anything away from the originals, you know.
Man, what can I pick a movie that has been remade that sucked, but and that's proof of why it can't be remade? Like Point Break. Feel like you can't remake Point
There's Break. So many 90s action films that are just like they just fit in that era. You know, it's like they just why remake them, you know.
And the 90s number was one,
a very special time for action films, you know, that just have that feel to them.
And I'll say number one, you can't remake it, is too Wong Fu. You can't do it. Because people like fucking flip out about it.
And I thought you were going to say Die Hard for a minute, but there's been lots of Die Hard remakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, Die Hard-esque. Die Hard on a bus, Die Hard on a boat.
I mean, you mentioned The Rock. It's Die Hard in Alcatraz. You know,
yeah.
but yeah.
If we don't get these hostages off this plane, off this boat, off this... off this vehicle, off this island, off the skyscraper, you know.
But
Too Wong Fu, man. Patrick Swayze, the only person that can pull it off with Wesley Snipes, and
it's amazing that they're talking about doing a Naked Gun remake. Liam Neeson, it's hard to make spoof comedies nowadays because of the political correctness environment. Like honestly, you know, Mike Myers has never came out and said it, but there's a reason there's no fourth Austin Powers movie,
dude. Can you imagine? Can't
do it now. Yeah,
the two Mike Asians Myers
has never from, said it.
from Goldmember, you can't
Myers
do that.
Always beat around. If you listen to Myers' answers, he always beats around the bush. But honestly, if you listen to what he's saying, he's basically saying we just can't fucking make it now. So spoof movies are just something you just can't do nowadays because of sensitive ass pussies, you know. But that said, man, other than reading a lot about this Crow remake, I did take some time to watch some things this week. I sat down and watched the Marvels. I actually kind of had fun with it, to be honest. It's a bit of a mess at times.
Dancing, you know, and it's singing planet.
Yeah, the singing part. That was that part in Wyatt was watching with me, even said that was weird. And it was super fast. Like it just kept moving. Like the plot's just going and going, and like a freight train, but not a good freight train. Like Mad Max Fury Road was just like, okay, is this movie going to breathe for a minute? But at the same time, I didn't hate it. You know, it was fine. That's why I
felt like the characters didn't just really connect. Like I felt like they should have,
forced. Yeah.
Yeah.
The girl plays Kamala is great. I give that girl all the credit in the world. She's really good.
She's trying to be the Tom Holland-esque with her jokes. Like in this movie.
That's fine. They're trying to introduce Young Avengers. I love the Kate Bischoff cameo at the end. I thought that was really funny. And she's like, I have an idea for a team. I got a kick out of that. It was fine. You know, I mean, I can see why... it wasn't as successful, you know, because it just didn't vibe with people. But, you know, I you know, I didn't knock it too hard. You know, it was a quick, easy watch. It was kind of nice to watch movies only an hour and 40 minutes instead of 3 hours, you know?
Yeah.
So it was cool, you know? I watched that. I watched the first episode, the new FX series Shogun. The first two episodes are out. I haven't watched the second episode yet, but I watched the first episode. Man, it's fantastic so far. Amazing acting, great production values. A really intriguing, interesting story so far through the first episode. I have a feeling this is going to be one of the shows of the year. I mean, it's off to a great start. Definitely interested to see where it goes. I need to sit down this weekend and watch the second episode and before the third one comes out. But if you're into Sunrise and feudal Japan and a really cool story, it's almost watching to be fair, it's like watching a foreign language television show. Almost the entire thing's in Japanese, except for some of the English characters. So it's all subtitled, but it's just really well acted. Hiroko Sanada, you know, he's the lead character in it. He's always good on screen. I always like him on screen. Mm-hmm. So it's worth watching. It's on FX, which is on Hulu. So if you have Hulu, you'll be able to access and watch it. Okay. Watch the latest episode of The Bad Batch, which was another good episode. Probably the best episode of the season so far. But no spoilers there. But if you haven't watched The Bad Batch, you're missing out on one of the best Star Wars shows of recent years. And speaking of Hiroki Sanada, I went back and I rewatched Mortal Kombat, the newest one.
Scorpion.
You know, I actually liked it better the second time I watched. The first time I watched it, I was really kind of like, you know, but the second time I watched it, I'm like, you know, this isn't that bad. Maybe I was just in the right frame of mind, or wrong frame of mind, I should say, the first time I watched it. And watched it the other night, and I was like, it's actually pretty good, because I know the sequel's coming out. Apparently, trailer's coming pretty soon. So I expect, I don't know when we'll get the trailer, but like I said, apparently it's coming pretty soon. So I was like curious, and you know, Carl Urban's going to be in part two, which is kind of cool. He's going to be playing Johnny Cage.
Yeah.
But you know, it's got some decent action sequences and so it's fun. And it's really bloody compared to the old school Mortal Kombat's, because rated R, it's a hard R. It was good stuff. I continued down my Godzilla trek and I watched the original Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, which is
nice.
It's good, but it's another one of those ones where, like, at this point, the series has gotten so weird in the Showa era that aliens send Mechagodzilla to Earth to fight Godzilla, and so that they can then take over Earth once they get rid of Godzilla, because he's their only threat. And at this point, the humans are just like, oh, these aliens are from planet X or whatever it is. Okay, that's cool. They just accept the fact at this point that aliens exist and monsters. And it's really just like kind of just funny how it all fits together. You know,
just like, oh, okay, cool.
Aliens. A robotic Godzilla. Sure. No problem. You know, it's
like, yeah, that's a thing. Doesn't surprise me.
And anyone's interested, all the Showa era films just became available on Vudu for purchase. A little expensive. But imagine they might run them on sale when Godzilla X Kong comes out here in a few weeks on Vudu. That's kind of what I watched.
The new Empire.
Strangely, had time to watch quite a few things this week, which is rare for me. So, and I know you watched a movie today, but don't talk about it yet because we're reviewing part one of that movie today.
Yes, I did watch Dune Part Two. All I'll say, go see it. It's awesome. Go see it. That's it. Other than that, that's all I can really say about it. I did watch the 1984's Dune because I never seen it. I didn't read the book. So I watched it, and it's Lieutenant Einhorn's in it as playing Zendaya's character.
Patrick Stewart's in it.
Sting.
Yeah. If you watch it having not seen the Villanova film, you'd be okay. I mean, it's not terrible or anything.
No, it's 80s, it's just, you know.
It's just super condensed, and it's
way, you know, too fast, man.
It's kind of like fragmented. It has an 80s style acting in it, you know.
The best parts are actually the slow parts. The parts where they're just like talking and planning, and the dream sequences, that stuff is actually pretty interesting. I feel like the dialogue, like the Baron is like a homosexual or something. That seems like the Baron's like a homo because he stares at his nephew and he's just like, fucking his nephew or something. It's weird.
The set designs are good.
Yeah. The only problem was the blue screen.
Yeah. And Kyle MacLachlan feels very miscast as Paul Atreides. That's probably one thing I didn't like about it. He just doesn't seem to fit for me.
Well, they wanted Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer. But what surprised them about MacLachlan is he had already read the book and he started talking about the book in the interview and, it just blew the director away.
David Lynch. Yeah.
David Lynch. Yeah.
Probably the most mainstream film David Lynch ever did.
Yeah. Before that he did Elephant Man. It's supposed to be, Scott Ridley Scott was supposed to do it.
Oh, if you ever get a chance, watch Lost Highway and tell me you understand the damn thing about that fucking movie.
Yeah. Highway. But yeah, Ridley Scott, his brother died while they had started filming, and then he vacated the project, and this was their only option. There was some other director that they had interviewed, but he wanted to do like a 10-hour film. So they're like, well, that sounds great, but no. So we got that one. It's 80s sci-fi. Basically, it made half of its budget back, which is why, it didn't get a lot of notoriety. But it's on sale for like $7.99. I didn't pay that because I just rented it.
Well, it's on Max. Stop. Check your streaming services. It's been on Max forever. It's owned by Warner Brothers.
Whoopsie. You know me. You know, I just give my money away. Yeah, could have bought some like Reese's peanut butter cups with that thing, man. That's right. That's what I had today at the movies. I had Reese's peanut butter cups.
Or more sex toys, you know, anything. But
of course. And then
things you like in your butt.
Wow. Whoa.
That's what Jackie said. That's all I know.
Anywho, I was looking around and, we're trying to watch a film together, me and Jackie. And we saw that Vanilla Sky was on sale. And I've never seen Vanilla Sky. Never seen it.
Another movie. It's on Paramount Plus.
Oh, well. I should know. That's you. Tom Cruise.
Start text me, man. Come on.
Yeah. Mark, next time I need to do that. Mark, tell me if this is streaming or not. But I ended up buying it because it was like $5 or something like that. And it's freaking trippy, man. It's so he's like, like typical Tom Cruise. Like,
Once. It's like, I didn't like it. I mean,
it's a weird twist. It's like he's got money. He's fooling around with Cameron Diaz and he meets this girl that he actually feels like he loves in Priscilla Cruz or Penelope Cruz and falls head over heels with her, stays with her the whole night. They're lovey dovey and he leaves her apartment. Cameron Diaz is stalking him and she's like, hey, get in the car and let's go for a drive. And she's like upset that he referred to her to a mutual friend as a fuck buddy. And so she starts like getting all crazy, attached white chick, on him. And she's like, I swallowed your, stuff, David. She's like, your body made a commitment to me, even if you didn't. And she's like going off on this big crazy ass spiel. And she just drives him off a bridge. He's disfigured. He has multiple surgeries. And then he signs up with this company that will allow him to like lucid dream until, he decides to terminate the program. And he's been dreaming for 125 years, but it looks like he's just been living his life when really he's just been dreaming. And it you know, unfortunately, the dream turned into a nightmare. And so, you know, he dreams that he accidentally killed the girl of his dreams, is the girl that he loves. And, you know, he makes a commitment to just go back to living again in the future, wherever he is. And then, but you don't get to see what that future is. Kurt Russell's in it. Brody is in it, you know, from the Kevin Smith universe.
It's hard to believe that movie's directed by Cameron Crowe. It's such a weird movie for him to direct. And the narrative's a little all over the place in it. And I don't know. I just didn't care for it. I was like,
it's definitely not one of those
too fucking weird.
Yeah. It's very weird. I think, it's one of those movies that's kind of like Eyes Wide Shut with Tom Cruise. You know, it's just weird, you know, but you would know Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah. That's a different kind of weird. Yeah. But Kubrick also directed Eyes Wide Shut, so you know it's going to be
Well, and I don't mind weird in movies, but sometimes they just go off deep ends where they just lose the audience. That's how I felt with Vanilla Sky. That's how I felt with Black Swan. It was just, it lost me as an audience member towards the end of the film. Just like, you know, when you get too far off the deep end, you're just like, no, okay, it's, you know, you're trying to be artsy or whatever they call it, and it's just, it's too much, you know?
Yeah.
That's just kind of how I feel. But, yeah, I think Vanilla Sky was also the movie that, if I remember correctly, it broke Tom Cruise's $100 million movie streak, where he had so many movies in a row that made $100 million. And I think he made that one, and it was not as successful, if I remember correctly.
I can see
that. What happens when you do weird, man? You know?
Can't go full weird, man. You just have to be a little weird. That's it.
That's right. Just stick with jumping on couches on Oprah weird, you know?
Yes.
And I'm weird in love popcorn with Katie videos Holmes. About I love my popcorn. That one that came out last summer, that was kind of creepy. Where he's sitting there you ever see that one? Where he's sitting on the couch going, I love my popcorn. I can't wait to go see Barbie and Oppenheimer. He's sitting on the couch eating popcorn. It's just weird. It's like, okay, Tom, you're freaking us out.
Everyone loses it at some point.
All right. Well, let's get to today's feature film. And that is, we just talked about Matt and saw Dune Part 2. And so we thought with Dune Part 2 coming out this weekend, why not go back and talk Dune Part 1, a movie that came out during the amidst the COVID pandemic. So it was one of those movies that was had a theatrical release and same day on HBO Max release. Mm-hmm. You know what's crazy? It did almost 30 million worldwide in its re-release last weekend before Part 2
came out. Yeah, that was nuts.
That's quite a bit for a re-released film. But I think people want to go see it on the big screen before Part 2 comes out. And I did not see Part 1 on the big screen. I watched it at home. And, you know, the first time I watched it, I was like, okay, you know, it's visually pretty cool, but I didn't really care for it that much. Rewatching it this week, I looked at it differently, and I think I liked it quite a bit more watching it this week.
Yes.
You know, this is a film that now I'll be before anyone jumps on our Twitter or our Facebook account or whatever and says, oh, Denis Villeneuve destroyed Dune. I have no idea what the books are about. I've never read them. Probably never will. I have no cat in the back.
Don't yell at me and Matt about this.
Okay. Cause we don't know. We're not no diehard Herbert fans, you know?
Yes.
We just watch these for films and what they are. And as an outsider looking in, I couldn't tell you what he may have cut from the film, what he didn't cut, and I don't fucking care, to be honest. You know? So this movie is about, I mean, it's a complex film, but essentially it's in the future or in another galaxy or wherever it may be. Because this is one of those science fiction films that just lets the world exist. It doesn't over-explain when it takes place or anything like that.
You
know, we know there's humans and there's some alien-type races and things like that. There's heavily detailed people of faith that have kind of like telepathic-type powers because of their faith and things like that. And none of it's overly explained. It just exists. So essentially, the world, the galaxy is run by an emperor. And he basically controls these houses from what I am I, and correct me if I'm wrong, because Dune to me is complicated and I'm trying to watch it and understand it more. And he controls all these houses and he basically tells them what to do. And Arrakis is the center of is the center of the universe, which controls the spice, and spice does everything in the future, from healing to running machines to the economy. You know, it's all based around the
space travel that expands your mind, expands your life.
So he sends House Atreides to Arrakis to find out why the spice production slowed down, what's going on.
To replace House Harkonnen.
And to replace House Harkonnen, because they're not doing the job he wants. But it turns out it's all set up, essentially.
Yes.
The Emperor wants the Harkonnens and the Atreides basically to go at war with each other. But he seems to be, at least in part one, to be siding with the Harkonnens more. Am I saying that right?
Harkonnens. Yeah.
He seems to be siding with them more than House Atreides, at least as it appears, because I think there's a twist in part two, or if I, you know, that he's not really, the Emperor's kind of doing his own thing. He basically wants both sides to go to civil war with each other. So Oscar Isaac, who plays the leader of House Atreides, is assassinated, and his son, who's Timothy Chalamet, is Paul Atreides, is believed to be like this planet believes to be him to be like the Mahdi. He's like almost a prophet, like a savior to bring these people whatever it is they're looking for. So they believe that his son might be assassinated, but in turn they end up assassinating him. And then there's this other group of people, the Fremen, that live on this planet, who don't want any part of the war. They're just trying to mind their own business. They don't even want the spice productors there, but they get caught in all land. They get caught in all of this because of the battle. And Paul is forced to leave his House Atreides and flee for his life along with his mother because of once they're attacked by the Harkonnens. Mm-hmm. And to shorten up this version of part one, he ends up finding the Fremen, and he's going to try to save his house and find out what's going on. And that's how kind of where it ends in part one. And I know I shortened a lot of this, but man, if you'd really try to explain Dune, we'll be here
the
all night.
Voice, the Reverend Mother and I forget the sect of people that can of women who can use the voice.
Like the Bella Jesuits.
Jesuits.
Yeah.
And Paul can use the voice too. Mother's been training him. Mm-hmm. And he's tested to see if he could be the prophecy. Right. And it looks like he can be from what the Reverend Mother tests. It's a big double cross. And then, you know, we get like a nice spiel at the beginning of the movie, just like we do in the original Dune, where they just kind of let you know what the spice production means to the universe and Arrakis and the Fremen and why their eyes are blue. It's because of the spice. Mm-hmm. The voice is much different from the 1984 film to this film. This film, it's like, it's epic, you know, mm-hmm. it's what it's supposed to be, but it's like they converted into a weapon in the 1984 film, to where it can like blow up rocks and stuff. I don't know if
I remember that. Yeah.
I don't know if that's actually in the books or not, but it was kind of odd to me.
Well, my first impressions of Villanova's version is the cast is amazing. I mean, you've got Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, Timothée Chalamet, Oscar Isaac, Rebecca Ferguson, Jason Momoa, Zendaya. I mean, and those are the main cast. And then the supporting actors, Dave Bautista is in there. Then the supporting cast is just as good. Everyone that plays the small bits. I mean, it's watching it feels like an old-fashioned movie where just fantastic acting across the boards from everyone and good performances. And then you have the tech of the film. The CGI and the tech work done in Dune Part 1 is seamless. Masterful. And really well done. These sets feel, they don't feel expect. CGI. Yeah. They don't feel CGI. They feel like they're in this world. It's amazing. The ships from the suits, all the tech is just really cool. I love the shields they have that vibrate and all that. That's just really badass.
Yeah, it looks way better than the 1984 shields that that are used that turn into like Lego blocks or something like that.
Yeah. And from the cinematography to the direction, I mean, we already know at this point that Denis Villeneuve knows how to shoot a film. I mean, from Arrival to Blade Runner 2049 to Sicario, the guy is second to none with the cinematography, the way he shoots a film. And Dune Part 1, and from what I've read so far about Part 2, this continues. The guy has just got an eye for film. You know, he knows how to direct a movie.
Yes.
And those are my initial impressions of Dune. And like I said, the first time I watched it, I still don't find the whole story of Barons and Spice super interesting. So the second time I rewatched this week, I kind of took it from a different approach. I tried to ignore the politics of it and enjoy it more for the tech and the fighting and the intrigue of it. And then once I did that and I put it all together into one package, I started going, okay, I get this now. I'm really enjoying it more. I'm not like any kind of hardcore Dune fan, but I want to see Part 2 now. And I think, so I just took a different approach watching it the second time. I tried not to be negative about the not that interesting story about spice production and Barons, to enjoy it for an overall production of what it is. And I think I focused more on the small things, watching Paul Atreides, watching his mother and their interactions and the little things that are done in this film. The small amounts of detail that are put into the movie from the director and the actors and their performances. And so I think watching this week, I enjoyed Dune Part 1 way more than I did the first time I watched it. And I realized, like, it is a really good film. I can see why it was nominated for Best Picture, why it won a few Oscars too, you know, cinematography, I believe, and special effects. And it's like, being the big Star Wars fan I am, I'm not going to knock the sequels at all, because I like the sequels for what they are. But like, man, I want to see a Star Wars film on this kind of scale. Yes. And I thought we would get this. I thought we would get that with the sequels, and the sequels have a scale, but not like this scale. Like, I want to see a Star Wars film to this kind of level scale. And that's what watching Dune Part 1 makes me want, you know?
Yeah, definitely. This is a film that you watch it if you are the layman, as I am, and you, you know, as far as like, you know, being immersed in the world of Dune, you know, we don't, you know, maybe dipped our toes in it, and that's about it. But the second time around, yeah, you know who the Baron is, the House of Harkonnen,
House Atreides.
I wanted to say Atreyu, and I'm like, it's not Atreyu. but yeah, you get the feel. Okay, there are these houses. There's an emperor, spice production, Freeman, and how it kind of coincides together. And you know, the weirding way, you know, which is how they fight in the first film. Whenever Javier Bardem's character loses to the mother, the character's like, whoa, you have a weirding way. Show us this way. Teach us the weirding way. And it's like, he just acknowledges, whoa, she has a weirding way. She caught me off guard. And that's it. You know, they don't make a big deal about it. And like there's some, you know, badass, you know, fighting group, which they are. They do fight well, and he does fight well in this film. Timothy Charlemagne and the mother, and they prove themselves. But I like how this film, you know, it takes you know, it's got some of the same things and same, you know, points that that 1984 film takes, but it separates itself and definitely, you know, makes itself elevated from that original motion picture that came out. And, you know, I feel like I want more. I almost, after watching these two films, I feel like I want more Dune. But I know there's no Part 3.
Well, there's the next book. And Villeneuve says if he makes one more, he'll make Dune Messiah, which apparently he has an idea to do it in one film, but he says he's not going to do more than three films.
Okay. Yeah. I think that these films are going to make enough to where he's going to be prompted to make a third film. I think it's going to happen. I really do.
And he said he wants to make something between the two, but before he does a third Dune, he does want to make he wants to take a break and do another film, then come back to Dune. I was reading that. So.
Yeah.
Because he said, he spent the last 5 years of his life making Dune. He wants to take a little break.
Yeah. If it took 5 years to make one film,
the first two films.
Oh yeah. First two films. But yeah, 2.5 years to make a film, 3 years maybe. Oof. That's a lot of time altogether. 8 years on three films.
Yeah.
It's a lot of time. But yeah, everything is well done. It's shot well. The angles make sense. You can see everything. They do a good job of showing the entire world. As far as, you know, what you can see on screen, you get like this grand scale of the world that they're in, that it's big and open and vast. In the original film, it's all like rooms. They're all in rooms, and it feels very tight and compact. And I feel like one thing Dennis does a really good job of is letting the audience know how big the world of Dune is, really.
Yeah, that's fair to say. Yeah. I appreciate just the scale and the scope that he tried to pull off. And like I said, I have no cat in the fight with the books. You know, from all I know, he pulled it off miraculously. And I've read that majority of hardcore Dune fans are pretty satisfied with his vision, you know, and what he's done. I love the epic size of the sandworms in his version compared to the old 84 one where they were just puppets.
Yeah.
You know, so I really like that. I continue to think that, you know, I've only seen Timothy Chalamet in a few films, and I think this kid is, man, he might be our next Tom Hanks style big time movie star. You know, we talked about on the show before that the movie star is a dying breed. Instead you have just, you know, actors. But man, this kid's got talent, man. You know, from Wonka to what he does in Dune. I mean, he feels like he could be a really big star. And that's not taking anything away from anyone else's film, because Rebecca Ferguson, she's always good in everything she's in. Javier Bardem is always great on screen. And Zendaya, for being a Disney kid and a singer, she's really good. You know, most of the things she's in, you know, that I've seen her in so far. She's a smaller part in part one. I know that expands in part two, but her brief screen time in part one is very important because she's part of Paul's vision. He keeps seeing this girl and he doesn't know what it means. And that's one reason whenever they meet the Freeman, he knows, even though he's warned against it, and even his mother is like, well, maybe we should just leave. He knows he has to stay, because when he sees Shandi, he knows that's who he saw in his dream, and he had to stay, you know, and he had a choice because he knew that's what it meant. So that's really, you know, and she's really good, man. I like some of the tougher guy characters too, like Josh Brolin's Gurney and Jason Momoa's Duncan. You know, they're like the muscle of the group and they're the badasses, but then they also have a couple of the more humorous moments, you know, when Oscar Isaac's character tells him, smile, Gurney, I am smiling, you know, and it shows that even in the, and I like that when a movie, sometimes the Marvel films tend to use too much humor when it's supposed to be serious, but I like slight humor, like in Dune, where it shows you that even in this world of political intrigue and things, that you can still have a moment to laugh. And I like it when humor's thrown in like that, just very subtly, you know.
And then it's almost like just a break.
It humanizes, you know,
it
humanizes them. It breaks it up. Yeah.
Yeah. And man, we haven't even talked about Skarsgård.
Dude, he chose his makeup. Oh, he's always been a great actor. He's a scene stealer. He told Villanova, I don't like motion shoots. I'm not doing it. I want makeup. And Villanova went and talked to production, says, do we have the money to do this? Can we do it? And they're like, yeah, we'll do it. So he sat in makeup to do his scenes instead of using CGI. And that's talk about dedication to the craft.
Yeah, dude. That's I like the the poison tooth scene, mm-hmm. just like the original film, but it's like they give the other actor like boils and warts. I like how they just kind of they have him kind of like sitting in a tank of like fucking tar, I guess. I don't know in there, you know.
Well, as a kid, and my dad was watching the original, and I didn't know what it was at the time. I just knew it was Dune. Yeah. I remember the boils and warts like really freaked me out. I was like, "Oh, this is scary! What the fuck is my dad watching?"
Yeah, weird. But yeah, man, he is a scene stealer, man. He mm-hmm. he steals it away from everybody in that film. Whenever he's in the scene, the attention's on him for sure. Yeah. Does a really really good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great, man. Everyone's good in this movie. I mean, you know, they really are. I mean, to be fair.
Man, and I knocked Charlemagne, Timothy Charlemagne. I thought it was Charlemagne.
Timothy Chalamet.
He's
not Charlemagne. Chalamet.
But, yeah, he wore a dress one time. And I was just like, ah, oh, this guy. I didn't take him serious. And then this film, I'm like, man, you know, he's pretty good. And then I watched Dune Part 2, and I'm like, this guy is going to be fucking up there.
Yeah. And then, well, just even the immense talent he showed in Wonka. I mean, he's just, you know, I mean, he took a loved childhood character and made a new classic in Wonka, you know, that people are going to watch for years, you know?
Yeah, no, part of me watching part two today, he looks, whenever I saw him, I saw like a flash of like Christian Bale or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I know he's going to be bigger than Bale. And I think Bale could have been bigger than he was, you know.
I mean, Bale's still pretty damn big. I mean,
he's still big, but I feel like, you know, he never had that like Tom Hanks box office draw status. Obviously he's big, but like having that draw that the big guy could be.
Chalamet could be the next Leonardo DiCaprio, the next Tom Hanks. He can be the guy who gets the Oscar nominations, wins the Oscars. He's that kind of talent, you know. And Bale is super big, but Bale never got the Oscars and the recognition, you know. And that's how Chalamet is. He can be that guy that gets that kind of award. And not that that's important, but he can be that kind of award guy that gets consistently nominated and consistently wins awards. And he's definitely a young talent on screen. And I'm looking forward to seeing part two. I heard you know, I want to stay spoiler free. I heard Austin Butler steals the show. I heard he's fucking awesome, you know. And again, another young kid that, man, just from watching Elvis and a few things he's been in, we know this kid's a talent too, man. Austin Butler's going to be a future star. I heard Christopher Walken's doing Walken things. He's great as the Emperor, you know. So
I need more spice in the inventory.
You know, and I heard Anna Taylor-Johnson, even though she was announced as being part of the cast at the last minute, has quite a scene stealing moment in it from what I've heard. So, you know.
She does. She does. And it was fun seeing her for that little bit. You know, they do have, and then Florence Pugh is in the film too. Obviously, you know, another person that is going to do her job when she's on screen, especially even in small parts.
I think that's the biggest complaint I've read so far from some Dune fans online, that I guess the character that Anna Taylor-Johnson plays is more important in the book. And I guess it's a smaller part in the sequel. And that's, these hardcore fanboys are complaining about that. I'm like, you know, whatever, you know, like I said, no cat in the bag. I don't care. Because from all intents and purposes, I've read that the film's a fucking masterclass.
Compared to how they used her character in the first film, I think it's way better. I don't think you can complain. You know,
she was in the first film though.
I know, but that character that she plays is in the first film, and I felt like it was very cheesy in the first film, just very weird.
So a different actress was in the first film.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you'll watch the film, and that's why I was like, man, I will watch your kids, man. I'll watch your kids if I can tomorrow, so that you can go see this thing. But yeah, man, go see watch part one. If you haven't seen part one, watch part two. This is you know, I'm pretty on a Dune high right now, man, just after experiencing it all. And I kind of want to buy the book and, you know, read the book now. you know, and that's, you know, the original director Lynch, you know, he, whenever he was introduced to Dune, he was like, he started reading the book and he got really, really pumped, you know, whenever he was going to make Dune. And of course he was upset that it didn't turn out as well as, you know, Dennis's films have, you know, right. But man, you know, he read the book and he was just like, this is good shit. Yeah, this is good stuff.
I read that. I read that when part one came out, that Lynch was like not ashamed of his film, but he saw Dennis's version. He's like, that's how you fucking make Dune. You know, yes. He was appreciative, you know, honored Villeneuve's version, but you know, he was proud of what they, were able to pull off in 1984 as well. You know, with the budgets they had and special effects. Yeah. You know?
That was a big budget for 84. This one was once like $164 million today. And I mean, it made more than its, you know, more than double its money back. So it was a success. And it warranted a sequel, thankfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this one's successful. Maybe we'll get the next book and get at least a trilogy out of it. Yeah. We'll see. But yeah, Dune Part 1 on HBO Max and, believe it's on Netflix too right now, and part two in theaters.
And for $5, you can get it on Vudu. $5.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad.
Yeah. So yeah, so man, good shit. Next week, man, yes, we'll get into preview of next week's film. Next week we are going to change universes and go over to the Marvel universe and talk about a film that's turning 10 this year. Mm-hmm. And arguably still my favorite Marvel film. I mean, I think overall, I really like this one a lot. And as well, and we know Marvel is not the most popular thing right now. It's taking a little bit of a step back as people are a little burnt out by it, but it doesn't take away from the fantastic first 10 years we got, you know, with up from Iron Man all the way to Endgame. And this is one of the best films in that series, and that is Captain America: The Winter Soldier.
Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier. He's a ghost. You'll never find him.
Join SHIELD to protect people.
Captain, to build a better world sometimes means tearing the old one down.
And that makes enemies.
Fast.
Ready? All it takes is one step.
People are gonna die. I can't let that happen.
Captain America needs my help.
When do we start?
We just did.
The price of freedom is high. And it's a price I'm willing to pay.
He told me not to trust anyone. This is how it ends. Everything goes.
Looks like you're giving the orders now, Captain.
Damn right.
We know the good guys from the bad guys.
If they're shooting at you, they're bad.
So, you know, next week we're going to look back on it and discuss it and talk about this is truly this is as much of an espionage James Bond style film as it is a Captain America film. That's what I really like about it a lot.
Definitely.
A really, really cool story. Some great action sequences. It'll be a fun one to talk about next week on the show. And
it's got GSP in it. GSP. George St. Pierre.
So,
he plays the bad guy on the boat.
At the beginning. I know. It just took me a minute.
And I was just like, God, Captain America's fighting GSP. One of my favorite.
But introduces, US,
yeah.
Yeah. Introduces us to Bucky, or brings Bucky back. And and we've covered the first Avenger already. So this is very much a true sequel to that, which will be a lot of fun to talk about next week on the show. But until then, therebelradiopodcast.com for all your Rebel Radio needs, and continue to follow us on there as we lead towards Comppalooza 2024 and our 10th anniversary show coming up sometime in May. As we look forward to bringing you all that good stuff, we thank you for all your support as always. But until then, this has been Mark.
This has been Matt.
Remember, as always, just go there and do it.
This is Booker T, Hall of Famer, and you're listening to Rubber Radio. Now, can you dig that, sucker?